Today's show is brought to you by Sport Blocks. Sport Blocks is changing the way fans participate in sports and provides a platform for investment. Besides offerings in basketball and other sports, Sport Blocks is passionate about bringing more owners into the sport of Kings with low entry points as low as $200. Headlining a new offering later this week is Max Player. He'll be running in the Preakness on Saturday, having finished third to Tis the Law in the Belmont Stakes and Travers, and closing to finish fifth in the Kentucky Derby. There's going to be a lot more information about everything going on about Sport Blocks and their new offerings over at sportblocks.com. That's sportblx.com. Go there for more details. Hello and welcome to the Players Podcast for Monday, September 28th. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, back with you again from the area known as the DG Flophouse up here in Saratoga, adjacent to the little house on the east side. Made the morning run up here. Let me tell you, I've been coming from New York City to Saratoga for 20-something years, never had an easier trip than the get up in Brooklyn at 5:30 in the morning and head up north. This may have to become a trend and the way to do things from now on. Got a really fun show for you today with a couple of different guests. A little bit later, we're going to have Price Bell of Mill Ridge Farm talking a little bit about what they have going on at the farm and his background in racing. But we're going to start off with a voice you've heard several times on this network over the course of the last couple of months. Very excited to get her take, not just on the action from last weekend and not just looking ahead to the Preakness, but with some special bonus coverage of tomorrow's Prince of Wales Estate, the second leg of the Canadian Triple Crown. And to talk about it all with me, we have Fort Erie analyst and general horse racing aficionado, Ashley Mayhew. Ashley, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you doing, Pete?
Things are good. I'm really, I'm in a good mood. I may hit the wall at some point from the early wake-up call, but I'm hoping that that I can continue to power through with aplomb. Let's start off by looking back at last weekend, specifically some of the win and you're in action for the Breeders' Cup. I love this time of year. I love when we get the last prep race is done, because I don't know about you, but I start to begin my Breeders' Cup prep, my Breeders' Cup study really in earnest now. Once we have not just video to look out of these races from the past weekend, but also speed figures and pace figures, I feel like no time like the present to start looking ahead to the Breeders' Cup. Does that sound insane to you? I mean, are you a more normal person who's going to wait a few weeks before really worrying about this stuff? Or are you an early bird gets the worm type when it comes to your Breeders' Cup study?
I guess I kind of do like a shallow dive at this point and try to get my, ducks in a row and try to figure out a general game plan. I mean, I don't really dig in until about 2 weeks in advance just to see what happens. I mean, we all know it's horse racing, so we might be just over a month out, but a lot can change. You know, it's the same with the Triple Crown. People ask me in February, who do I like? I'm like, I don't even know who's going to be in the starting gate, usually on the first weekend, the first Saturday in May. So I like to be patient with it, but I don't think there's anything wrong with doing some homework early.
Let's talk about the Awesome Again Stakes. Improbable, so visually impressive in victory, going by the whole field in what looked like a matter of strides. You don't see that too often. This race came back pretty strong on the clock as well, with a 108 buyer speed figure. Timeform US gave the race a 127, translating to almost exactly the same as buyer. What were your general thoughts on this year's Awesome Again?
I thought it was a huge performance. I'll be the first one to admit it. I've never been a huge Improbable fan. I think when people ask me about him, especially in the first few months of 2020, all I'd say is he's a miler. He's just a miler. And he's definitely definitely wrong. I'll say it. I was wrong. You look at this, you look at the Whitney. I mean, he's been very impressive, and I think he's matured a lot. He still has some quirks and some antics sometimes in the gate, but he got a perfect break. And Bob Baffert, I'd read a lot of pieces on different sites. He'd said there's going to be enough pace, and he was right. I mean, it was a perfect ride that he received, just sitting off the pace and just making that huge move. That's probably one of the highlights of this past weekend as far as the races go.
I would agree with you, and I was questioning distance for him, but the distance I was more questioning was the mile and a quarter. I still feel, and maybe I'm being difficult here, I still feel like there may be a question about if 10 furlongs is his best distance. Yes, he won at 10 in the middle of these other impressive races, but I felt like he was just so laid out for that effort, and I felt like the quality of that field not as strong as what he's going to be facing in the Breeders' Cup Classic. So when you evaluate him moving forward, at this point, are you just willing to say, okay, he can get whatever distance he wants? He's obviously improved as a four-year-old. Or do you still hold out some trepidation when it comes to the 10 for him?
I feel like just because I didn't like him before, I have some trepidation. I don't know. It just was a horse that I couldn't really get behind. I mean, we all have this for unexplainable reasons sometimes. I do think now I have more confidence, you know, in him for a mile and a quarter. I do think when you get a full field in the starting gate at Keeneland, things can play out differently. It's just you're getting kind of the creme de la creme all in the starting gate, and he hasn't had that yet. He's faced good horses and great horses, just not all at once. So I think that can change things, and just the race complexion can be different than what he's gotten so far. So I'm not going to, you know, handicap the Breeders' Cup Classic and think, oh, he can't get the distance. He can, but, you know, I think certain things will have to go his way if he's going to find himself in the winner's circle. But he's been, you know, performing quite strong so far this year, so I can't really knock him at all.
It's been unbelievable, and to see him getting over the trouble in the gate, I think has clearly been one of the things that has helped. Though, as you pointed out, he's still been a little unruly in the gate before breaks this year, but he may be over that, he may not be. He's just a horse that, as the favorite, given the questions I have about him, my first blush, and you know, there's time, as you pointed out very eloquently before, for things to change and pictures to change. But going there as the favorite, I'm inclined to be just have a healthy dose of skepticism. I thought you made a great point too about talking the quality of these fields he's faced. And the horse, the main danger on paper, certainly from last Saturday, appeared to be Maximum Security. This is now the second race of his in this comeback run that hasn't been terribly visually impressive. I came away from the other night, despite the fact that he got a second in a grade one, being kind of disappointed about him and wondering which direction, not really wondering, knowing which direction the arrow in his form cycle was going, and it's not up for me. What do you think? Am I being too harsh on Maximum Security? Do you think this is a horse who could rebound and be a big threat in a race like the Classic?
I think he could. I think look at his trainer, Bob Baffert. I mean, he has these horses cranked at the right time. You know, people had their doubts about Authentic in the Derby, and he was able to get a great trip, and he was able to overcome his quirks. In the case of Maximum Security, I won't lie, I was disappointed. I wish the finish would have been closer, and, you know, I would have picked him on top. I already said I'm biased. I can't keep on bringing that up, but I am. You know, I really liked him, and it was disappointing. I don't think I'm going to take him out of my top three as far as rankings go. I still think, you know, his comeback race, that was kind of a mixed opinion from everyone. Handicappers, you know, experts, just people that wager in general, either liked it or you didn't like it. And I thought he'd overcome a lot, and I was happy with that. This wasn't what I expected or necessarily wanted to see, but I don't think it's some drastic, you know, failure of a performance from him. He just was really second best, and the winner was much the best. So, you know, you may change your rankings a little bit, but I mean, I still think he has a shot. I actually think, kind of looking at the Classic in general as a field, I don't think I have this go-to horse that I feel confident in singling on top at this point. I mean, we see Tom's D'Etat got the bad break in the Whitney, and how do you, you know, kind of regroup from that, not having a start since then? I think this is a really wide open race, or it should be, depending who ends up going.
It's going to be very interesting to see. I will say this about Maximum Security, given the hands that he's in, if there is something wrong, or if Baffert were to agree with the opinion that he might be on the downtrend, I think it'll be pretty simple. We probably just won't see him in the race. They've already done a lot to secure his future value by coming back and running as well as he has and experiencing grade one success in the new barn and getting away from the stain of the old barn in terms of Coolmore and his future as a stallion. They've already done plenty. So if he's not ready to fire his best, I suppose he just won't show up. So I think that's a key point you made. Given the hands that he's in, if he's going to go there, he's going to probably go there with at least a chance. From a betting point of view, I'm inclined to be skeptical, but we shall see what happens as far as that goes. Surely a lot more news to come. We'll talk about another key contender in presumably in this year's Breeders' Cup Classic coming up in just a minute. But first, I do want to look back to a race that had a lot of interesting conversation, because we've seen a lot of chat on Twitter about these type of performances where they're visually very impressive, but the clock says something else. And more often than not, the right move, and it's not being a hater and it's not, you know, being overly cynical, I don't think, but more often than not, I've found in my gambling experience, it pays to take the cynical approach when that happens and go with what the number says as opposed to what the eyes say. I'm talking about the performance of Princess Noor in The Chandelier, which I thought visually made her look like one who was going to be really tough to beat in the juvenile fillies. And then you see it come back with a speed figure, 78 on the buyer scale, that doesn't win a good maiden in California. And looking over at Timeform US, very similar, just a 95 translates to about a 75. So which is it with Princess Noor? Is it the eyes telling us that she should be at the top of the market for the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies? Or will it pay to be cynical gamblers looking at these numbers and lining up to bet against her?
Well, I love buyer speed figures. I know some people don't like them, and I use them. I don't cling to them for dear life and saying that, you know, you said a 78 is the end of the world. I mean, visually, she looked phenomenal. It looked easy. She looked relaxed. I mean, for your a two-turn test, I mean, she did everything right. She was much the best. And, you know, Victor Espinosa even said, you know, this is one of the best fillies I've ever been on. And I think that speaks volumes compared to maybe the buyer number. You know, I could see there being some kind of reservations or doubt seeing the buyer number the final time. But at the same time, when you win like that, you're not really being asked as much as you could be. I kind of don't worry about it as much. But you do have a valid point. I mean, not an ideal buyer that you'd want to see after a performance like that.
We'll see what happens in training as well. As a two-year-old filly, certainly plenty of room to come on between now and the first Saturday in November. And it may just end up being one of these, well, I'm going to use as a backup anyway, because in Baffert, we trust. In Baffert, we trust gets you to cash a lot of tickets when you're talking about thoroughbred racing in general, and certainly it, at the biggest grade one test. Was there anything else from the win in your in races that stuck in your mind? Any horses you felt like calling out? Obviously, you could do a whole show running through all of them. We'll have plenty of time to go back and look at these races between now and the day. But I just wanted to give you a chance to call out anything that was of particular interest.
I think, you know, overall, the races were pretty impressive. I thought Mucho Unusual, very impressive in the Rodeo Drive, you know, getting that grade one win. And for me, I think looking at the other races, I thought the Santa Anita Sprint Championship Stakes, that stood out to me. I mean, CZ Rocket has been quite strong, and to kind of see that performance and being able to get the job done. I thought it was a beautiful trip that Luis Saez gave the horse. They went quick. And for me, I'm really excited about seeing where he goes and, you know, his future as a racehorse. That would probably be the next one that stood out to me.
I would imagine they're thinking sprint, but they could be thinking the dirt mile. We've seen over the years a lot of times when East Coast speed and West Coast speed meet up. The same way I always like turf form shipping west, I will typically be prejudiced in favor of dirt sprint form shipping east. So certainly, actually, as predicted before the last race on our airwaves by Tyler Hoffman, CZ Rocket certainly looks like a legit contender for the Breeders' Cup Sprint. Do you like him more for the sprint or the dirt mile, or would you pretty much be giving him a second look no matter where he shows up?
I'd give him a look no matter what, but I think for him, the sprint is probably where I would put him personally. I mean, hey, I wish I would have claimed him when you could have for, I think it was like $40,000, right? It would be a nice return on investment. But yeah, I think sprint would probably be where I'd just put him based on that performance alone.
Let's look ahead a little bit to the Preakness. I didn't realize how early they were drawing. Our own Naomi Tucker, part of the team, doing the draw today at Pimlico. I don't know if you've had a chance to look into it, but obviously lots of great storylines here. Authentic, obviously, one of the big ones. This is a horse. If it's not going to be Improbable as the favorite come Breeders' Cup Classic Day, I would imagine Authentic is probably the other top contender for that honor, unless there comes some crazy workout buzz for one of the others. Or, of course, if somebody else were to win the Preakness, that would be a different story. But if you were guessing at who the favorite's going to be from here, Authentic certainly has that opportunity. And then you've got Art Collector getting to take his place in the starting gate. Probably would have been the second choice in the Kentucky Derby. Minor setback. Comes here fresh and ready to roll. Great story. Easy people to root for in that corner for sure. And now we also have the news of the filly. Swiss Skydiver going to be taking her spot in the field, challenging the boys. From this far out, you know, I'm sure you haven't had time to like properly handicap the race or anything, but any particular horses or storylines that you're drawn to for next Saturday's Preakness?
Well, I think as far as storylines, not even horse specific, but you look at the riders this year. I mean, Accession, you have Sheldon Russell, talking about the local riders, Jesus' Team, Javian Toledo, Horacio Caramanos is going to pick up the mount on New York Traffic, and then Trevor McCarthy, Live Your Beast Life. I think it's really cool. You know, it's an interesting weekend. I mean, this is like a super Saturday, and for so many reasons. You have the Preakness, you have Keeneland going, Belmont's big weekend. Some of these local riders are picking up mounts that they typically wouldn't and getting that opportunity to shine. So, if one of them wins, I think that's a huge story in itself, especially if they're just picking up the mount. But trying to do my homework early, I will be on site, so I will get to finally meet Naomi in person and work alongside with her a bit this weekend for the Stronach Group. But, you know, to me, I mean, Authentic, John Velasquez gave the beautiful ride. When I was watching the post position draw today, they did some nice little featured segments where they had previously recorded segments with Bob Baffert, with John, and Steve Asmussen, and just to kind of hear their thoughts. You don't realize, like, Authentic, he's been very quirky. He's another quirky horse in the Baffert barn, and I believe it was in the Sham they showed the stretch run. I mean, when he gets out there by himself, he kind of gets, I don't know, nervous and full of himself. And, you know, John was talking about when he talked to Mike Smith about him and stuff, just, you know, let him see another horse coming, and then he kind of grows up and gets focused and gets in the race. And, you know, the trip that John was able to give Authentic and the Derby was perfect. He was ready to go. You know, Bob Baffert had him ready and cranked to go in that race, but I think a lot of it had to do with the ride. So I do think he'll be tough. I think the post draw worked out well for him. I think Art Collector, with his sort of run style, I think post position three is perfect. But a horse that, if I'm looking for a price and trying to figure out, I was really high on New York Traffic as kind of a exotics play in the Derby, but I'm wondering about Mr. Big News. I thought the performance that he put in was really good. I mean, how exciting was it to see him kind of make that move, you know, coming for home and entering, you know, the stretch run? I thought it was a huge performance. So I don't want to take anything away from him. And I'm always price shopping. So I saw 12-1 morning line. I was hoping it would be a little higher, but I'm not going to complain.
We'll see what happens on the day. There's a lot of those storylines can end up catching money. I mean, Art Collector on the saga could catch money. Authentic, clearly, after going off the price last time around, they'll be coming for him in a very big way. Swiss Skydiver, there's a lot, 1,000 words getting a chance to take his place in the gate. I wouldn't be surprised if you get north of 12-1 on Mr. Big News. And yeah, this is a horse for me, kind of came out of nowhere in the Derby, but one I'm planning on taking a long look at as well. I'll be doing a full horse-by-horse write-up over at thetheraces.com. We've got tons of Preakness coverage this week. There's going to be the return of Let Loose with our friends at Twin Spires later in the week. Also going to be doing a special presented by our Sport Blocks friends. We mentioned Naomi a couple times. She's going to be involved. Stephen Crist is going to be involved too. We're going to have a little panel discussion on Thursday night about the Preakness and some of the surrounding stakes. Should be fun. You can follow all of our coverage in themoneypodcast.com. One nice way of getting everything we're putting out in one place is to subscribe to our newsletter. If you go to inthemoneypodcast.com/email, you can sign up for it there. I think you can just sign up when you go to the homepage too. You just might have to scroll a little bit, but appreciate that general overview of the Preakness from you. And that's awesome that you're going to be on the grounds. What will your main responsibilities be, Ashley?
We're just putting the schedule together now, but a lot of handicapping segments and different things. I'll be also doing some little videos for social media with Jason Blewett for some of the stakes races. So a little bit of everything. It'll definitely keep me on my toes.
That's awesome. Remind folks where they can find you on Twitter so they can see all that stuff.
Yeah, for sure. My handle's Ashley_Mayu. Good luck spelling it, but I know I'll be tagged in the tweet when it's posted. But yeah, I'll be on there a lot on social media, and that's probably the best forum to kind of reach me out on.
I'll give you a hint. It's not M-A-Y-Y-O-U. So, but the tagging in the tweet is definitely the most efficient way to do it. And I'll be looking to amplify some of that content as well. I really look forward to what you and the team come up with. It's always a pleasure of having all the people you mention on the show. Ashley, let's look forward to some early week stakes action. I love the fact that you're here not just to talk about the Prince of Wales Stakes, but knowing our audience, you suggested the idea of talking about some of the races that surround this one. Let's look at this late pick four sequence, if you're still game, for Fort Erie on Tuesday, September 29th. Obviously, nobody better to talk about Fort Erie than you. You've been studying this form for how long? How long have you worked there and how long have you followed it?
Well, I followed it since I was about two. I don't know how loyal of a follower I was at 2 years old, but I was. That's kind of where it was kind of started for me, right? I mean, this is the track that I grew up going to, growing up in Buffalo. From my house, it's about a 25-minute drive with crossing the border, as long as you're not asked 100 questions. It's a really easy trip to get there, and I love it. I mean, I think it's one of the most beautiful infields I've seen. The paddock is gorgeous. We got foliage from the trees and plants. It's really scenic, and it's a really peaceful place to train horses. So I love it. I'm biased. I like small tracks. I like big tracks. But for me, Fort Erie is really special. And as far as handicapping the races there, I started in 2018. So this is officially my third meet with them.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Let's talk about the sixth race that kicks off the late pick four. We got some cheap claimers here. $3,000, three and up, five furlongs on the dirt. I don't value my opinion enough on Fort Erie to, I mean, I'll chime in eventually, but I'm not going to go first when I have the opportunity to throw it to you. What do you like to start off this late pick for?
So, I mean, to me, the three, you know, at 2-1 morning line, Eyes Forward is probably the horse that stands out. You kind of look at the connections going back into a barn that had done well with the horse down at Mahoning Valley, this winter. The Buttigieg Barn, that's where they go and they spend their winters, and they do very, very well there. I think their win percentage in the winter is like near 30% or maybe even a little higher. So seeing this horse, you know, had a couple of starts in 2019 at Fort Erie. Was in kind of those maiden claiming races and showed early foot and couldn't stick around. And then this winter, I mean, never was worse than second, beaten by a neck. So I think, you know, this horse coming off of that second place finish at the $8,000 level, now just dropping in for our lowest tag, says a lot. And I think, you know, the horse has early foot and there is some other pace setters in here. But to me, this horse probably looks the best on paper. I will say a couple others that I'd look at. The two Get the News. This is an interesting, a very well-bred horse. You see a son of Tappet. When he first made his appearance here at Fort Erie in mid-June, he took on allowance level 9-2 lifetime, and he won by a neck on the turf. And if you watch the replay, he's kind of a chicken. He's a big horse. He's gorgeous, but he just kind of doesn't want to go through when like a gap opens. He's just kind of hesitant, which has been something to watch with him a little bit. Next time out, they put him on the dirt. I thought he was third. The winner, very respectable horse who was just much the best and kind of one of those horses that gets bowled on the front end. And then just looking at that most recent performance, you know, it was in for a slightly higher tag. It was a muddy track. It was only his second dirt start. I thought that was a pretty big performance with the way the track was playing that day. So those are my top two. I thought looking for prices, though, the seven stopped victimizing me. Another horse that just comes out of a race. The first dirt start coming out of that same race, it was muddy, tried to rally from dead last. I think that horse had a lot against him. I mean, we know this. Horses that get mud in their face for the first time, it's overwhelming. So it's not 12-1. I thought that was a huge price potentially.
I wanted to ask, at the lower claiming level, do you tend to do anything different than you would at a higher claiming level in terms of being more open to chaos? Do the lower level races tend to be more formful at Fort Erie in your view? What general advice can you give folks who maybe don't play Fort Erie very often who will be tuning in for the big race tomorrow?
So I think part of it is to also look at just the surface. You know, we know this in any level of racing, sometimes it's really hard to get on the turf because of the weather. And some trainers just know they have a horse that can't pick up their hooves on the dirt. So they may be racing this horse for lower than they normally would just to have the opportunity to race on the turf. With the dirt races at Fort Erie, I mean, you kind of look at some in here. I mean, you see a horse coming off of a second place finish, well, in for an $8,000 tag, and now you're probably scratching your head and saying, wow, they're dropping this horse. What's going on? And I don't think there's anything going on whatsoever. I mean, horse is going to find a softer spot, you know, just making the third start since February. I don't think, you know, I do anything really differently. And I think sometimes the claim price, you'll see horses that are, they're all exiting maybe a $4,500 claiming event. And this is just the spot at the distance that they want. So you have to be kind of mindful of that at times.
Yeah. What the race that comes up in the book, it might not be a raise or a drop as much as it's in the ballpark. And that's the race that was available. Let's talk about race number seven. We've got $4,500 claimers, three and up, going a mile on the Fort Erie turf. Where was your eye drawn here?
So before we even talk about that, this is on the turf. I will say weather-wise, I know we're supposed to get some showers overnight. I don't know how heavy, so that may change things. Okay. So, you know, if this gets adjusted, it'll be at a mile and 70 on the dirt. And I don't know, I'm like 50-50 on it as of now, what I think will happen weather-wise. But I struggled in here between actually stablemates, the three Thor's Thunder and the four Kilkenny Prospect. I look at Kilkenny's Prospect and I say, you know, he had his fair share of chances to break his maiden. He just did it last time out, but he did it decisively. And I even thought his performance before that going 7/8 on the turf, he was against maiden special weight company and he just missed. And looking at the trip that I figure he'll get, mile's not going to be a problem for him. He's just going to have to have a good setup. Now, in the case of his stablemate, who I ended up actually using as my top pick on the sheet that I'm just wrapping up now for tomorrow. He's coming out of these allowance races on the dirt, and I'm kind of looking at some of the horses in there, and he's faced some decent dirt horses. Now, looking at his most recent turf effort, he was third. He was part of the pace scenario. He just held around for a minor share, but, you know, the runner-up came back to win next time out, and it was a maiden special weight event. So I just like that consistently he's always been facing better, and he's faced winners a couple times where his stablemate hasn't. So those were the two that probably stood out the most to me. An interesting horse that I would definitely still use on my ticket, who will need to show some improvement, especially if you're looking at buyer numbers, is the six Giant Balls of Fire. I've loved this horse since his first appearance at Fort Erie. I just had a feeling, looking at his two races at Tampa, he had that 1 mile turf event in April or March. And, you know, he didn't get a good break. He's been far back. And if you look at his races, that's how he usually runs. I mean, he's usually dead last or near the back of the pack with a lot of work to do. And he's almost gotten it done at shorter distances. You know, in his first race, they took him 5/8. He missed by half a length. I was rooting so hard for him because he, you know, offered a little bit more value than other horses in the race, but not too much. And that's what he does. Now, last time out, I do think something went amiss. I mean, that was on September 21st. So they're racing him 8 days later. And for that barn to do that, I think they have whatever happened figured out. And I think going from a 5/8 race to a mile, that's going to be perfect for him.
Well, that's interesting points, and good to point out that barn tendency as well, because when you don't know the connections as well, you can kind of get caught in between on that sometime. My super obvious thought was just that Thor's Thunder looked really strong on either surface, and one thing that I particularly liked looking at pace figures was that the other main speed, potentially, to me on paper anyway, looked like the stablemate, and I figured they wouldn't duel and that Thor's Thunder might just get loose and lonely in there. So I'm with you as far as that one goes. You mentioned the picks you do on the sheet. For those who are looking to play the whole card, what's the best way to get your information for Fort Erie tomorrow and every night they run?
Yeah, we do certainly tweet out a bunch either on my personal Twitter account or on Fort Erie's, which is Fort Erie Racing on Twitter. But if you go to the website, you can go to forterieracing.com and then you click the betting tab and then there's a tip sheet tab. So those will be posted. Wanted to have them done already, but I've been taking my time figuring out the weather. Trying to be the weather girl as well has been difficult, but those will be out probably in a couple hours. I have one or two more races to type up, but I'll have a full race card analysis with about a paragraph or two for every single race.
That's fantastic. I'm glad you didn't throw me under the bus and admit that the real reason you're late is this annoying guy bothering you to do a podcast and then talking to you for half an hour about other stuff. But anyway, let's move on to the featured race of the day. We're talking about three-year-olds fold in Canada with $400,000 in the pot, a mile and 3/16 on the dirt, the Prince of Wales' stakes, and some familiar names in here to those of you who were paying attention a few weeks ago at the Queen's Plate. Who's going to win this year's Who's going to win the Prince of Wales stakes?
Hopefully I have as much luck as I did last year because I love Tonebroke. Tonebroke won. Really big performance from him. I hate to be the crusher of Canadian Triple Crown dreams, but I'm going to do it. I think this race might set up really nicely for Clayton. So I'm going to make Clayton my top pick. He's 5-2 morning line. You know, when you look at the Queen's Plate and the way it played out, and, you know, I believe we had talked about the race a bit, and I was just kind of always concerned that if a horse got the lead and didn't have to battle too much, and got to the front that they were kind of going to be able to take the field gate to wire going a mile and a quarter on the Tapeta, because we saw one bad boy did it the year before. And in the case of Mighty Hart, I think he had to work a little bit more than one bad boy. But when he poured it on the stretch, I mean, no one was really coming. Belichick made a late move. In the case of Clayton, I think Clayton was at a disadvantage because he was just sitting a couple lengths off the pace early on. Then he had gotten up to second. It was just hard chased throughout. And I think at that point, you know, Mighty Hart was able to really turn it on. Now, on the dirt, yes, I do think Mighty Hart has this benefit of early foot. If he wants the lead, he can probably make the lead and try to do the same thing. But I just, you know, drawing comparisons from last year, you see one bad boy, he made the lead in the Prince of Wales, and he wasn't able to sustain his bid and, you know, ended up finishing third. Avi's Flatter was second for Josie Carroll, and then the winner was Tone Broke for Steve Asmussen. So I just think the trip that Clayton's going to get, ideally, I see him early on in the race settling in about third, just to maybe 2-3 lengths off the pace and making his move. And we've seen when he's kind of settled about a length or two off the pace, he's kind of been able to just make his move gradually to the front and get the job done. So that's what I'm kind of hoping and thinking happens. But part of me also wants to see the Canadian Triple Crown stay alive, because I believe the last horse to win it was in 2003 with Wando. You know, and you look at Mighty Hart, does have that dirt race, and it was the debut, and I don't want to take a lot out of it. I don't want to read into it too much. It's not like he got defeated by 20 lengths, but it's not like he was beaten by, you know, 2 lengths either. So I think with that being his debut race, it's hard to say, but, you know, looking at 40 Erie, especially in the two turn races, sprinting, it doesn't really matter. You have early foot on the dirt there. It tends to, you know, play to your advantage.
I wanted to pick Clayton. I just held back. You make a great point about the dynamics being against last time, maybe, but I just felt like at the critical stage of the race, once again, he got a little bit goofy, and just in terms of his, just the way he was like carrying his head and his overall gait. I was expecting him to look a little bit more professional, like he had apparently done in the workouts ahead of that race. Is that am I overthinking it here with Clayton? Do you have any fears that he just might have, as talented as he is physically, that he might have something mental holding himself back a little bit?
A little bit. You know, you bring up a good point with that, too. I mean, I think that also plays into maybe why he wasn't able to really close the gap at all. I mean, he was defeated by almost, 10 lengths in the end. And Belichick, I think looking at the trip that he got, he was further back and probably had the most impressive trip besides the winner to make up that sort of ground. And I was really hoping we'd see him in this race, but understand why we're not going to. I think he does have a little bit of greenness, and we've seen it before where, you know, Raphael's asked him and he still won by, you know, open legs, but you can see that he's not just 100% confident in himself, and maybe he just needs more experience. You know, what is a critical time? Like you said, it was the big stage, the big race, and he didn't have it all together. But we'll see what he can do on the dirt. That's another question. I mean, you see the pedigrees by Bodemeister out of a Smart Strike mare. Looking at his works, you have to go back to his, you know, second to last work before the Queen's Plate. But I thought that move over the training track, which is a dirt surface, was respectable. And even looking at some of his earlier ones in July this summer over the dirt, I think he should be fine. But I do think you bring up a valid point of, can he kind of get his act together?
I'd like to see it. I think he's a cool horse, but I ultimately went with Dotted Line. Bit of a guess here, given the lack of finish in the last day and the questions about the surface. But I think this is a talented runner who's just going to get a very different kind of trip here, especially if Clayton, I think you're probably right about Clayton being a little bit off the pace, but if he can attack early enough and this can set up for a runner to come from off the pace, I feel like Dotted Line may have a shot to at least get up in the number, but maybe even win. What are your thoughts on this runner?
So I use Dotted Line for the rankings, I think, as like fourth or fifth in this race, because I'm still sort of confused on the pace scenario. I mean, you have to think Mighty Hart is going to go, especially having, you know, the two post position and just seeing what happened in the Queen's Plate. Now, looking at Dotted Line, I mean, two starts back, he made the lead early on in the plate trial and just was outfinished. I mean, that's what the run chart says. Clayton got the best of him, and so did Halo again. So it's interesting because you mentioned if he takes kind of the wait and see approach and Wraiths off the pace, you know, three starts back against Cheryl Spite in the Marine, that strategy didn't, you know, turn out too poorly for him. He rounded out the try. And I think kind of looking at other horses in here, the 7 Tecumseh's War, you know, was kind of just stalking throughout and kind of pushing right behind Mighty Hart and didn't have enough. And that's kind of been a trend in some of his races, is that he's been, you know, even looking at his races earlier in June, he had gotten the lead late and just couldn't get the job done. So I'm going to be really concerned and curious what dotted line does, because I think that could really switch things up. For me, I think you bring up a good point too. You probably see dotted line, you see a price potential. And I think in this race, you kind of have to price shop, knowing that Mighty Heart's going to be short, Clayton's going to be short. So dotted line was the one that I considered using for my price, but I actually went to the 8 Muskoka Giant.
Let's talk about the Muskoka Giant case. For me, I do think in my horizontals, 3 and 9 is going to be most of what I do. But I want to hear a little bit more about Muskoka Giant too.
So I think looking at Muskoka Giant, the performance 2 back when he broke his maiden on the turf, it was going a mile. I understand that the half did go fast. I mean, they went 23 and 1, 45 and 4. I mean, they, you know, cranking kind of for a mile on the turf, but he was dead last early on, and, you know, they always say he circled the field, but he went extremely wide and was still kind of much the best in the end, almost drew off by a length. So I'm curious to see what happens in here on the dirt and seeing how the race unfolds. I wouldn't want to see him that far back. I'd like to see him closer. Really wasn't thoroughly impressed last time out in that Tapita performance, but that was only his, you know, second start over a synthetic surface. And I know the dirt's going to be a question, but you see his pedigree.
Should work.
Yeah, I would hope it would work, you know. And then the thing for me, kind of looking at horses tuning up for this race that might have, you know, made the bypass and not raced in the plate, you see Muskoka Giant, Bold Victory, a couple others in here. That most recent breeze out of all the horses from a times perspective on the training track at Woodbine going 47 and 4 just really stands out to me. I mean, that's very, very quick. So, you know, I got the pedigree angle going. I got that work. You have Mark Cassie, Kazushi Kimura, great team right there. And I'm, like I said, I'm price searching. So for a horse in the trifecta underneath, I'm surely going to use this horse, especially if he's anywhere near the morning line.
You've convinced me to at least throw Muskoka Giant in for a penny. I do love the idea that this one could potentially move up onto the dirt. Do we have an update on Kimura? And he's the one who, he had the spill, didn't he, last week at Woodbine? Is he all cleared and going to be riding, do we know?
I haven't seen any updates. I knew that I believe he was involved in a spill and he was taking the day off is the last thing I heard. I hadn't seen anything else, and I don't, you know anything on the news side. I don't think 40 Degrees come out with a statement or anything yet. So as far as I know, he's still in it.
Something to pay attention to there, but a very interesting long shot and good thoughts in general on what should be a fascinating contest. I love having stakes racing early in the week, 400,000 on the line at Fort Erie. I should also probably mention that one goes at 5:37. So I'll run through the times really quickly. That first race, the sixth race we talked about, 4:35, race 7, 5:04, the big one at 5:37, and it all wraps up with our nightcap. We've got $4,500 claimers, 3 and up, going 6 furlongs on the dirt. Ashley, how are we going to get paid in this Prince of Wales Day pick 4?
I actually thought this might be the most challenging race in the sequence. Kind of looking at the field, you got 9 horses in here, but you talk about horses that want to make the lead. I feel like half the field, if they had their ideal setup, they would be on the front end. And you kind of I tried to weed through who I thought was maybe quicker than others. I thought, Emma Jane Wilson's going to stick around for the nightcap and maybe try to get the late double, hopefully with, I guess, Tecumseh's War and then the number 9 Stolen Identity for Built Theranos. You know, this horse won by over 15 lengths here at the beginning of the meet on June 9th. Yes, it was laying for the $3,000 level, but was much the best. And it was a very, very easy win. Had the, at the time, Nikki Alderson aboard. And looking at the performances since then, this one's going to go to the front. It's probably going to clear the field. You look at some of the fractions. I don't know if it's going to be as easy as it's been in the past, but that race here suggests, yeah, this horse can make the lead easily. And if this one can do so, very bold on the front end. One last time out as a heavy favorite. Was pretty much asked in that race, but I expect this horse getting back on the dirt to kind of even step up even more. So the 9 stood out to me. I thought the 8 Summer Retreat's interesting because looking at this horse from a win perspective, 4 wins at 40 Erie from 10 starts, is yet to miss the board. A lot to like there. I think looking at the distance of the race, 6 furlongs, great. Last time out went 6.5 and was just second best behind Brady O'Brady. And this horse has kind of emerged in the claiming game this year. The horse has always been consistent for underneath, but has had some really big performances, a career best number from him this year. And my concern with Summer Retreat, and that's why I'm debating whether I'm going to certainly use him in the pick 4, is his best races come when he makes the lead easily. And if you look at this race for 2 seconds, you know that's not going to happen. He's not going to make the lead easily, because if you think he's going to, you have to think Stolen Identity can get to the front and get the job done. So I'm hesitant to leave him out, especially if he's going to offer value, but he might have his odds stacked against him. And then kind of looking at the horse that I think might get the good setup, who I'm definitely going to use as the horse on the rail, the number one, Be the Change, who was claimed earlier this year for 3,000 and come out of a win. And this is a horse that's also consistent at Fort Erie. I mean, we're talking about has this year 2 wins, you know, has hit the board almost every single time, and last time out 1. But I think the key is this horse likes to sit from off the pace, and I know the pace is going to be honest enough. So I have to think this horse might get the benefit of all this, you know, pace action early on, if that's certainly how it unfolds, and maybe he'll get the job done. And I hope he stays around that price as well, because I think 5-1 would kind of be a gift on him, because we haven't really gotten in his last couple starts anything higher than 3-1.
One I'll mention here, as we talk so much about lone speed as handicappers and horse players, and you mentioned Be the Charge, you could certainly pass horses, but I see as more of a stalker ideally. What about Captain Sydney in the rare but potentially potent lone closer angle? I thought this one in the race 14 days ago maybe moved a little early into a pace that was on the fast side, or at least coded fast on the time form US fractions. What about with more of a hold up ride? Can this one possibly make an impact in this nightcap? Do you see that one at all?
Yeah, I think for me, it's interesting. You see Jeff Alderson's going to climb aboard, and he had an injury earlier this year. He's just got back to the races. He had a huge winner, I believe, the other day at Woodbine that paid over $100 to win. But Jeff can certainly ride, and I kind of like the rider change here. I look at the effort on, you know, we're going to talk about a horse that's going to make 3 starts in a month, which, you know, it's a lot of races for this horse, but he looks like he's actually found himself in a spot where he can kind of hang with the competition better than he could earlier this year. The performance, like you kind of mentioned last time out, maybe they went too early and asked him too early. And I agree, because if you look at the effort 2 starts back, yes, it was a softer spot at the time. It was, you know, he's only in for a $4,000 tag, non-winners of 1 on the year, but he just missed. I mean, Be the Change, you know, got lucky and won by a neck, but this was a horse that was closing from last, and they had him further back, but they had him kind of, they asked at the right time. It was just slightly too late. So I do think this horse is intriguing. That's why I said this race is really tricky to handicap. I mean, to me, kind of, if you go by buyer numbers, you see someone like Omi's Boy, who's got a pretty big buyer last time out for $3,000 claimers. You know, people might laugh at that, but we're talking about a 74. I mean, that's pretty good for that level of racing. And, you know, I like went through this race. I don't know. I probably spent 30 minutes on this race, and I'm still not 100% confident to round out the pick 4. But luckily there's a 20-cent minimum. So maybe I can sneak a couple prices in there and load up heavier on that last leg.
All right. I like the plan. Love having you on. We're going to be watching you with great interest early in the week at Fort Erie and later at the week down at Pimlico. Ashley Mayhew, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks so much.
Before we get to the next guest, just a reminder that Sport Blocks is one of the sponsors of today's show. And later this week, we're going to be doing a really fun Preakness special, Stephen Crist and Naomi Tucker. Thursday night, it'll drop, brought to you by Sport Blocks, a Preakness preview. And we'll also be talking to Joe DiPerio of Sport Blocks about their latest offering and talking about some of the fun stuff coming down the pike. For more information about Sport Blocks, check out sportblx.com. And now, as promised, I'd like to welcome to the show a man I'm proud to call a friend from Mill Ridge Farm, Price Bell. How are you, my buddy?
I'm great. I'm great, Pete. Yourself?
I'm doing well. You know, I was upset that you have been on these airwaves before, but it was an in-the-ring show when I was absent. I was over in England, and JK hosted instead, and I felt so left out, but I'm excited to get you here to yap about various matters now.
Absolutely, and let's give Tugel some credit too. Tugel was also on the call. It was JK and Tugel, you know.
Sean Tugel has not been heard on these airwaves for quite some time. He's had a lot going on in his life, another mutual friend of ours. He's changed jobs. He's had a child. We'll have to, you're reminding me how badly we need to catch up with him. And speaking of him and industry stuff, what's been going on with you, Price? And I assume this has been a crazy time of year with the sale just completing, or the sales, plural, just being completed.
Yes, it's been fascinating. You know, Pete, You know, we had the Keeneland September sale, which is, you know, typically the largest, you know, marketplace for yearlings in the world. These past 3 weeks, we sold nearly $250 million in gross receipts over the past 3 weeks, which was great. I mean, just the fact that we had a sale in and of itself was, you know, tremendous. All credit to the Keeneland team and, you know, working with a variety of government officials to pull it off was really seamless. And then prior to it, we had the hopefully once in our lifetime September showcase sale from our friends at Paisley Tipton, who worked with Keeneland in creating safety protocols that made the whole process really, really incredible to just be hosting a sale. And I think that at Phase, they probably did, you know, 30 to 40 million. You might confirm that, but so all told, there's been a little bit less than $300 million worth of yearlings traded over the past month, which is significant. I mean, yearlings are our traditional crop as commercial breeders, and so just to have a marketplace this year has been, hats off to everyone who worked so hard to get it done. I will laugh, though. We typically have a warm-up. You know, you have a sale typically in July at Phasic Tipton, then you have another sale at Saratoga. So you kind of have these sales to get you kind of in the flow. And this year, we basically dropped and ran a marathon. It was a long pull. And as a runner, as you know, it's hard to come off the bench and run that kind of endurance. But so today is the first day I've been in the office since August, probably August 29th. So
that's crazy. Well, thank you for taking time out of the busy schedule to come on here and join us. You remind me, I don't think I've told the listeners this yet. I am doing a virtual New York City marathon this year.
Are you?
And
really?
I am. And I'm not going to run the whole thing. I'm looking to do like a 50-50 walk run hybrid. I'm going to be out there forever, but I wanted to do it. I wanted something to focus on this year to, like a positive thing. And then there's the connection that producer Craig, DJ Unstable, works at the Roadrunners Club. So he was looking for people to produce some web type content. It just sounded like so much fun. The excuse to work with him, the excuse to train and to be doing something healthy in this time where it's so easy for me to hunker down and focus on fun eating and drinking stuff. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I did decide I'm going to get out there. So it'll be interesting when you see me, assuming I'll see you at Breeders' Cup this year. I may look a little worn out because I will have just run a virtual marathon.
Well, so are you going to do the actual route of the New York City Marathon, or do you do it?
Absolutely not. Part of doing a virtual race is creating your own course. I mean, you couldn't, you'd get hit by like six cars if you tried to do the actual route. I'm going to make something up in Brooklyn. It's going to involve a lot. It's going to be something on the order of run Prospect Park, big loop one way, run the exterior of Prospect Park one way, run them both the other way. And then I'll probably end up, down at Greenwood or something. I'll figure it out. It's a work in progress, but it's since you mentioned marathon, I thought I would.
Does it have to take place in a borough, or could you do it up in Saratoga, or even do it in
theory? I could do it anywhere, but I want to do it in New York. I want to do it in the city. You can do it. You can do it anywhere in the world. And I think that you can apply and do this on the New York Roadrunners website. If there's anybody out there who's in that kind of shape that could pull that together in a month, and then they give you a window and you get it set up and you go. So it's going to be interesting. I'll put it that way. And hopefully we're going to come out on the other side of it. Okay. But I digress. I did think back to Keeneland Meets Past of going running with you before the sun was even out in your lovely neighborhood in Lexington.
That's right.
You know, that was a ton of fun and a good way to get a start of a horse playing day at Keeneland going, to get some good exercise and get the blood pumping. But I want to talk to you more obviously about Mill Ridge and what you guys are up to, and I definitely appreciate that high level update on the sales. But one thing I've always thought that I wanted to talk to you about on the air that I thought horse players would appreciate in particular is your perspective on the relationship between horse players and horse owners, because it feels to me, and I don't know if this is a generational thing or what, maybe you can give me your perspective, but it just feels to me like people I know in the breeding industry who are your age and younger have more of an interest than ever before in the horse playing side of the equation. I don't feel like that was as, I'm sure there were exceptions, but that was as much the case as it was 20 years ago. Do you think I'm, A, do you think I'm right about that? And B, what for you personally made you interested in the horse playing side of the equation as opposed to just the business of racing, the horse breeding side?
No, I think you're absolutely correct in that there's a lot, I feel a lot more playing from our generation. And I don't know if that is related to fantasy football, more, you know, the gamification of other sports, more sports betting, the ability to bet on your phone, the ability to bet, I guess it's a lot easier to bet, frankly, than just going, you know, if I was a kid, you could bet at Keeneland, you could bet Keeneland OTB. I mean, I'll never forget watching my cousin Gaywood put money down on Chalukis Exacta on the nose. And I think back on it, he was a very early adopter of not putting caveman tickets together.
That's awesome.
But yeah, he had, I think it was Chaluki, who was a Cherokee run over, oh gosh, who was she over? And he put like a $50 or $100 straight Exacta. And I don't know, we were maybe fifth, sixth, seventh grade, and he cashed. And it was amazing. And now he has all this cash and he takes it in. I mean, he's a kid. So, I mean, we're not a kid. We're very mature for our age, but he hides it in his sock drawer until his mom finds it, which she was like really perplexed by the whole thing. But, you know, we were in sixth grade, seventh grade. Like it was a big score, frankly. And it was, and to his credit, you know, he was an early educator of mine on, you know, allocating your bankroll appropriately. And I really didn't, but I didn't really, I mean, I recognized it, but I didn't really learn to, you know, play it through until you all started, you know, the In the Money Media Group and doing incredible podcasts and really celebrating horse playing and making, you know, conversations, whether it be dinner with you and Mike or Sean, and then listening to your interviews and podcasts with everyone, that I really developed a greater appreciation of the game of horseplay, if that makes sense. I mean, I say the game because it is a strategy and it is about developing an opinion and then betting that opinion. I think growing up, I more bet personally on connections, breeding interest, et cetera, but actually like really running a race in your head and then whether it be playing horizontally, playing vertically, and developing and crafting that opinion, I think has, you know, really for me grown over the last, you know, call it 3 to 5 years, frankly.
And I think can remember even pre In the Money days, I remember talking to you that first year. I think we might have met the first year of the Paddock Bar when I was just doing the Unbearable Betting blog,
right?
And maybe through John Panagot or someone like that. Absolutely. And I remember I was just, I think I was playing in the contest, and I don't know if you'd known much, if you'd known about contests, you didn't know much about contests. And I just remember the interest you took in it as somebody in the industry. And I wasn't sure if you were interested from the level of, hey, this is something that you personally wanted to participate in, or that you were just interested as somebody who, you know, was born into this game. And we'll get to a little bit of your background in a minute. But as just a potential new way of attracting people, which is it, or both?
You know, I would say it's more on the attracting people. You know, I personally, like, I can dedicate the time. So we have a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. And, you know, when I sit down to bet, it was funny. I was looking at my Naira Bets ROI tracker, which, you know, again, as someone who has handicapped my entire life, I had never really kept any track of it. You know, per se, you know, it's like I'll spend $100 this weekend or that weekend. And if I, you know, came out with more than $100, I was eating a different meal for dinner, you know, or buying more rounds of drinks for people. It was not like,
exactly,
you know, it's all because I, you know, to me, I believe the whole sport is about high fives. Like it's about sharing with someone, whether that's, you know, a score, a bet, you know, it's about bringing, like to me, horses have this incredible power to bring people together and share moments. And so that's how, I mean, that's a little bit of where I come from, the game from. And it wasn't until Panigat and yourself, like, educating me about contests. And then Scotty Calder loved playing contests and loved kind of its what it did. And then I think associating the contest play with kind of fantasy football and understanding that overlap, and then understanding my own personal enjoyment of playing fantasy football, again, as a way to fellowship with friends. And so I think that, you know, it's been, and then you get to, you know, more ADW betting, and then understanding how to put it all together is really, I don't know, it's really enriched my personal, it's really enriched my life. Monetarily, not so much. I think my ROI track over the last 3 years on Naira Bets is pretty much break even, but it has enriched my life of watching, you know, racing and understanding form and cycles and those things very much.
But I do notice
when I do the homework and dedicate the time to doing the homework, I do better. I've had great success the last couple Breeders' Cups because I've, you know, watched the morning workout reports and then in the mornings, I guess who does them? Mike Pena does the morning reports with Jude, and then listening to your all's horse playing show leading up to the Breeders' Cup last year. Like, I'm really listening to Sean, and I guess it was Paul Matisse talk about the Munnings turf sprinter for Peter Miller.
That's great.
That ended up coming in second by a nose, but paid $40 for second. And it was just really interesting because I think Paul and Sean both like talked about wanting to use the horse, but neither explicitly said why they wanted to use the horse. They just kind of thought it could kind of the way it could shake out. And I used the horse and it really made for a great day and really got me started into the whole weekend of racing, which, again, I probably had never really played that way. The idea of building a bankroll, starting small and then trying to take bigger risks kind of as the day progressed, if you kind of built your bankroll to have like a really big day. So anyway, I don't know if that answers the question or not, but those are.
It does. And it leads to a whole bunch of follow-ups. Before we get to them, we'll button this up about the 1999 Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies. Okay. So Chalukyi was second to Cash Run. Does that sound right?
Well, I think it was the Saratoga race. I think that was it, the Skyler.
This was not in the Breeders' Cup.
It was not in the Breeders' Cup. I think Chalukyi, and that does sound right, but I think it was when Chalukyi, it was definitely at Saratoga, and I think it was the Schuylerville or the Adirondack.
That's fantastic. That's right, because yeah. Chalukyi went. She went there as I think she was actually the favorite in that Breeders' Cup, with Surfside being the other Lucas horse.
That's
who
right.
ran third. Cash Run, the 30-1. That's what made me think it might have been that day with the 30-1 shot in there. But anyway, we're all over the shop with the conversation, which happens sometimes with horse racing. There's so many different ways I want to go here, but I'm going to start with this one. And this is a question I've asked other horsemen who have a respect for horse playing, and I want to get your take on it. A lesson, something that you learned about the horse racing business from a horse player. I'm always interested to know what horsemen can learn from horse players, and then, of course, what horse players can learn from horsemen. I'd love to hear you speak on that topic for a minute.
So I guess two things kind of come to mind. One would be, you know, the top jockeys do a lot of handicapping for you and understanding kind of relationships between jockeys, who's riding well, especially coming to maiden races, first time starters, et cetera. I think horse players have kind of given me a greater appreciation for the kind of the jockey handicapping, especially, you know, predominantly a lot of my handicapping comes at Saratoga, kind of in the summertime, Belmont. You know, I don't do as much Gulfstream kind of winter handicapping for no particular reason other than I enjoy the kind of the spring, summer, fall. But I think also really and truly horse players have given me a much better appreciation for trips and trip notes and biases and just trying to – and then comparing, you know, charts within a day and really trying to – you know, look back and watch replays and see if there was, you know, something sneaky that could have happened in using a horse in a particular way. I think also I've enjoyed the variety of horse playing. Like, I never would have played pick fours, pick threes, pick fives, any of that until, you know, the last, you know, year and a half, 2 years, and just trying to, you know, find a single and then surround and understand, you know, how to play that. So I think those would be kind of the big kind of three takeaways, if that makes sense.
What about in the other direction? Is there something that you hear us wonder about that you feel like, from your horseman perspective, can be a little bit more easily explained, or something that you feel like horse players consistently overlook that, that from your perspective as a horseman, you, you can see the reason why it happens?
Sure. I mean, I think from, yeah, maybe not like when I think of horsemen, I think of like, you know, horse care. I think from a breeding standpoint, why people would take chances in stakes and black type, and understanding kind of moves like, you know, a move that, you know, a move that one trainer might make or one ownership group might make, which may be questioned, maybe like, oh, why would they do that? What do they know? And recognizing that, well, if they run third, they're getting, you know, black type, which will carry with them in a pedigree forever. You know, I mean, there's such a bump in black type performance, especially graded black type performance, in a mare's residual value that I think sometimes it can explain better, if that makes sense.
Change the, it changes the risk reward equation significantly when you're thinking about the entire family and or just the future of a particular horse, particularly when you're talking fillies and mares, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, colts, you know, we just, you know, you only retire the absolute, you know, 0.001% of colts who race. So it's not as significant, but, you know, wondering why a trainer might ship to, you know, Oklahoma, you know, the Remington Park for last night's, you know, grade three, you know, Oklahoma Oaks or whatever the technical race was called, Remington Park Oaks, I guess. You know, why would someone do that versus not, I think has, I think is what, where a breeder would come from. Does that make sense?
Understand. Yeah, totally.
I mean, also, and then, but maybe also like in making stallions, like you'll see, I mean, the job that the Rapoli team did on overanalyze, you know, I mean, you forget he was like one of the top freshman sires of his generation. And a part of that was that, you know, and he stands at Windstar, of course, but part of it was they, you know, they had a bunch of New York breds and they were running them at Belmont in the spring and they had a bunch of winners, clicked off a bunch of winners, and it built up some momentum within his stallion, I guess, prowess, if that makes sense, that it kind of carried him another year of recruiting mares because he kind of clicked off so many winners in the early stage of it, if that makes sense. And I don't know.
It makes perfect sense. And this is something you need to be looking for, you know, as it's happening as a horse player. If you can see what's going on and paying attention to the hot new sires and trying to get onto them before the crowd does, when you're handicapping maiden races, having some knowledge of the business of breeding, I think it could pay really big dividends. And I think somebody in your position would be much more in tune with what's going on than somebody just looking at the paper. You know, it feels like you're going to catch on to these trends that can definitely lead you to some winners. One other area, I mean, I think maiden races is probably the number one area horse players can learn from horsemen, not just from the stuff you've been talking about so far, but also just the differences in where horses come from. I mean, I feel like for the first 10 years I was a horse player, I didn't really look at the form of a maiden race with much difference in my head between a homebred, a horse that was sold as a yearling, and a horse coming out of a two-year-old in training sale. And I feel like the more you can – nowadays, I feel like a maiden race at Saratoga, without looking at it a little bit through that lens, it would be very hard for me to even handicap it. Is that – do you think I might be on to something there with how differently you might look at a horse in a maiden race depending on how they came to the owner's possession?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's funny you talk about the way that you look at the form 10 years ago. I will bet that we look at the form totally different. When I look at the form, the first thing I look at is the sire, the dam, and the breeder. Like right in the center of the form is the first thing that I look at. And I bet that you look at the record, the trainer, the jockey, something else, which I think is just an interesting question. Like it'd be on a t-shirt, like, you know, are you the center of the form or the upper right or the upper left, you know, and just how you analyze it. And I think, you know, a great, you know, I adore the Humphreys and Rusty Arnold and that, you know, their whole, what they've done, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Humphreys are incredible sports people and incredible breeders. Knowing that they love winning at Saratoga, you know, gives me personally as a particular example, you take a second look at, you know, a rusty horse at Saratoga than you might, you know, at Ellis, if that makes sense, because the Humphreys like to spend the summer in Saratoga and want to win there, as an example that comes to mind on the intention. And then relative to the 2-year-old versus yearling, I think, you know, I do think that you find consistency within breeders. And so if I see breeding line items and knowing the farms, knowing the breeders and kind of their programs and what they would, you know, breeding, they typically breed race horses, they typically breed sales horses, et cetera. I think at times that can give you, you know, a potential edge, if that makes sense. I mean, you can kind of consistently see what breeders are putting out good horses, good percentage of winners, runners, stakes horses, et cetera. And I think that can give you an edge too, if that makes sense.
It does. I'll give my oversimplified version that you can comment on. A homebred, that's a horse that I'm going to be a lot more forgiving of a couple of sort of, I mean, it depends on the operation, of course, but let's just talk about a theoretic, because I feel like you see one of these every year, every other year, like a Judmont homebred with Bill Mott that has a couple of six furlong races. Maybe it's even a 3-year-old, you know, let's talk about specifically a 3-year-old. This would be a much more relevant example. And then, you know, they get to Saratoga and they're going two turns and now they're doing more what they were bred to do. And you can kind of, you got to throw the form out the window. Like they're, when a horse like that with pedigree that they have every reason to be patient with starts going farther, I feel like you could be seeing a completely different horse in a way where if this was a horse that went through a sale that had a couple of races early that were meh, I'd be a lot less forgiving. That's one example. Yeah. I feel like that's pretty simple that people could start paying attention to right away that might be able to help them out.
Absolutely. Especially if those are fillies, you know, especially if those are filly, if you're talking about a filly where they would breed from it and continue to breed from it. If it's a colt and it's throwing you that many mehs, I mean, it's not likely to become a prospect and you might not get as much weight, but if it's a filly, absolutely. I think that's a great example.
What's the biggest difference in a maiden race for you looking at a horse that comes out of a, you know, maybe a high priced yearling sale horse as opposed to a 2-year-old in training horse that's sold, you know, for a, let's just use a theoretical one because you see a lot of these at Saratoga too, one that maybe sold for a big multiple of the sire's stud fee out of that 2-year-old in training sale. How are you going to approach those two horses differently?
You know, from a betting standpoint, I'm very much skewed towards the hands that they've come through. So there might be 2-year-old consigners that I have a lot of regard for that sold a horse for a lot of money. I would think, man, that they run a program like, you know, Calipari's UK Wildcats, and consistently they put out top performers. Then I'm going to put more weight into that sale result, if that makes sense. There are other programs like maybe Calipari's Memphis Days when he could have Derrick Rose came out of it, but he was the only NBA player to really kind of come through it at that stage, if that makes sense. So I don't know that the price is as much as it is kind of the program in which they came through, because, you know, we're a nursery, so we take horses from conception through high school graduation. When they leave us at Millridge, they go on to college where they're taught how to be ridden. And our hope is that we have raised horses that are confident, that have good bone, good strength, et cetera, but that trust humans, you know, and trust the relationship of human and horse, but have the confidence instilled within themselves. You know, a lot of self-confidence. We keep horses turned out in herds because we want them playing with each other, competing with each other, et cetera, because that's where we feel like where they really establish that self-confidence. Because in the race, it's really the manifest of the herd dynamics, right, where one horse needs to be better than another horse. And so that's what we're striving to do. And, you know, thus we're very reliant on those that do the quote unquote college training, you know, the people who do the 2-year-old transition from teaching them how to be ridden, et cetera, because they're a big part of that schooling. They're a big part of that program. Right. And so that's where I think probably from a breeder, from my standpoint, I probably evaluate kind of programs that horses are brought through, as much as I do anything else, if that makes sense.
And where do you get that information? I mean, obviously you're gonna know some of it just from being an industry person, but how do you, you know, that's not necessarily information that's printed right there in the form, is it?
No, you're right. And so you know, the top 10% of the elite kind of level, the ones that are running at Saratoga and, you know, Del Mar and those places, you do have a following it kind of throughout the year, understanding what horses have been talked about at sales, what horses are expected out of sales, et cetera. You have a pretty good idea of it. You can find the information online, you know, within that on the form where it says this horse, you know, sold for $400,000 at OBS June. You can go to OBS's website and look at the horse's breeze, and you can look at their catalog and, you know, the consigner. And then they publish, you know, kind of consigner results are published by the blood horse every year, both at the yearling sales and also at the 2-year-old sales. And then, you know, the TDN also will talk, especially the expensive horses that have been sold. They'll talk about expected, like exciting maidens or touted maidens that are coming through, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. And it seems like something that, you know, just you talking about it makes me wish I did more digging on that. Cause I imagine you start to see some of the same names and you start to develop. I mean, you know, you can get it. You can probably get some implication, some indication of what we're talking about through the trainer and what hands the horse ends up in. But there's probably some fun research to be done that might pay some dividends down the line as well.
Absolutely. And trainers have, you know, tried and true relationships as well. You know, like the Starlight partnership that had Authentic and Charlton, and, you know, they're very close with Eddie Woods, and Eddie Woods does a great job preparing, you know, their horses and many others. And likewise, you know, Baffert uses Barry Eisenman and his family and his wife for preparing a lot of their horses for as 2-year-olds as well. You know, Chad uses, you know, the Brennans and both Ian and Niall and a variety of people. So you start to kind of see the various relationships kind of matriculate, if that makes sense. In fairness though, I mean, I think also as horse players, you find that there is so much information and so much data that you've got to be able to separate the signals from the noise, you know, but I think that a lot of it is part of the story to tell, if that makes sense. Like getting back to why is this horse being pointed for this race versus another race? And I think a lot of that, depending on the owner breeder connections, can help dictate part of that story.
JK talks about that all the time, how he likes to read the past performance from the bottom up and tell the story of the horse. Well, the reality is the story of the horse begins even before there's one line on that page. And so it can really inform the whole horse playing process to have some at least cursory knowledge of what's going on breeding wise. We could talk about this for a lot longer. I've already kept you longer than I said I would for the whole chat, and we haven't even gotten to one of the main reasons why you're here. You did talk a little bit about the nursery aspect of Mill Ridge. You've talked about your interest in horse players. I want to hear about you specifically. I mean, you were born into the business, but was it something that you were always going to do? At what point did you know that you were going to follow your family tradition and be a horseman yourself?
You know, It's a great question. I have always loved this business, this lifestyle, you know, because frankly, you do it as so much that it's more than just a business. It's a lifestyle. It's a, you know, and that's working with family. That's, you know, this great quest to try and, raise better horses, and, you know, impact a generation, you know, of horses, and further it, you know, trying to breed a better animal. And within that, there's also whether that's, you know, we had the great pleasure of working with and raising Point Given. We also had the great pleasure of standing Gone West and seeing kind of Gone West impact on the breed. You know, and that dates back to my great grandfather contributing to the breed when he imported a horse named Fairmond II, who became the father of Me Now, who became the father of Tom Fool and then Buck Passer. And Buck Passer is, you know, prominent in a lot of bloodlines, especially along the dam side. All that said, I graduated college and was dating a girl who was investment banking in Charlotte. And so I moved to Charlotte and got into commercial real estate to kind of be with her. And I really enjoyed it. I was told I could be the CEO of a $40 million asset and in managing and leasing commercial office space. And so that sounded like a great suitcase skill for someone who was 22 years old. And so I did that for a year and a half. The girl and I lasted not so long in the same town. We were very good at long distance relationships and not necessarily in the same town, which is great. She's a great, great person, but we didn't make it as a couple much longer. And then I moved back to Nashville. I'd gone to school in Nashville and stayed in commercial real estate and had had some great success with it and really enjoyed it. And for a period of my 20s and into my 30s, really thought I might have that career and then come into the horse business, from an owner standpoint as a second career. But then the opportunity presented itself to come back and work at the farm in 2010. And it was a great time transition in my life and at the time my girlfriend's life, now wife Beth. And so we made that move back to Lexington in December of 2010. And it's been, wonderful. And, spent a number of years working with my dad started a consulting business called Nakoma Bloodstock. And 1978, so worked with Nakoma and then have moved over towards being more on the farm, working with the horses, which has been just the greatest privilege of my life, frankly. It's been really wonderful because we're so lucky. We have the nicest and most wonderful clients who love the horse and love this quest that we find ourselves on, right? Which is about breeding and raising, the best athletes that we can, and seeing them perform at the racetrack. And it's like the greatest business of hope, right? Like, I mean, we bought is a quick vignette, but we bought over a period of time from call it 2010 to 2016, about 12 or 13 mares. And within that, most of them were in foal. Now, the last mare we would have bought and probably would not have bought her again is a mare named Sweet Assay. And we paid $17,000 for her as a maiden. But because we're in the buying mares, we thought it was a good opportunity. We bought her. Now we own 5 mares. We've, traded out of some of them. And she's the most valued mare because in her first foal, she produced Analyze It, who, mm-hmm. is a point of entry, who has been second and third in more grade ones than I would care to remember. But he is an awesome horse who just came back right before the first weekend of the September sale and won at Monmouth so well in the mile race and is being targeted hopefully for a big fall campaign. And so here is, to me, he embodies so much of what we're trying to do, which is raise talented racehorses. And just the fact that he didn't run at all at 4 and he's now come back at 5 and Chad's incredible handling of him is, gives us great reason to, and excitement and waking up every day and seeing he worked yesterday, he had a good work. And anticipating means, his next start. That's what it's all
about.
We've
seen this movie before from Chad Brown with Phillies and with Colts. They can come back from these long vacations and reach new heights of form. So we'll be looking at that. I have to bust your shoes about one thing, just because, we're friends and it'd be a host fail if not. When you said, just explain to the listeners, when you said going to school in Nashville, that's the type of humble brag, like somebody from the Northeast saying they went to school at Cambridge. a Vanderbilt guy. I have to throw that in there.
Well, thank you. Yeah, fair enough. Fair play.
That's
funny.
That's a great overview of your specific trajectory into the business. I want you to talk a little bit about Oscar Performance and having this stallion on the farm a little bit. I know you'll be hearing more about that and going to be hearing some Millridge ads across the network on various shows. But I'm just curious to get your perspective about having a stallion on the farm.
It's so wonderful, especially because he's a stallion that, you believe so much in. Mr. Mazzamerman, John and Jerry have been so generous in supporting the farm for a long time. You know, Bobby Frankel was a dear friend of my grandmother, my grandfather, my, you know, and so he introduced John and Jerry Emmerman to my grandmother, and it's been, and dad, and, you know, they've been a great, you know, a great client and great friends of the farm for, gosh, I'd say, you know, every bit of 16, 17 years, which is tremendous. And so Oscar was a horse that, you know, we raised. Actually, as a matter of fact, he broke his maiden, Pete, at Saratoga. We were hosting a bachelor party, and we had this incredible show pool going that you were helping me tip. And he went around the tree right next to where you sat in your booth. And I mean, we had, you know, 20 guys all, you know, predominantly from the North, you know, in banking and this and that. And Oscar paid, you know, he might have paid $10 to show, which, like, you know, was, you know, nearly a 5X on whatever pool we had going into it, to a point where we had, you know, we were placing, you know, I think we placed a $1,500 show bet, which put us out. But it was so funny to me as an aside, you know, here we are, we'd all put $20 in, and now it's a $1,500, which would have broken down to, yeah, it was going to be okay. But I said to everybody, I was like, look, guys, we're either going to eat at the wishing well, or we're going to eat at Mexican Connection. And we're not quite, we don't have the bankroll to eat at the wishing well yet. So, you know.
I hope it wasn't my horse who blew up the show parlay.
No, it wasn't, but it was so funny just how, you know, because at that level, people were like, oh, we should hedge this, shouldn't we? I'm like, guys, we start with $20. Like, I mean, where are we going to hedge this? Like, let's either do it or not do it. But anyway, so Oscar breaks his maiden, and I was so shocked by the performance. And, you know, in Standing Stallions, you know, you've got to find something you really latch on to. And here at Millridge, you know, we've always been raised to, like, brilliance is what you latch on to. You know, is the horse brilliant? You know, when we weren't buying stallions and standing stallions at Millridge, we were buying shares. We owned shares in, you know, for a period of time in Quality Road and in horses that showed brilliance. And so, you know, that day at Saratoga, Oscar showed brilliance. I mean, he won by 10, 11 lengths. I mean, just galloping past him, was a PD and Rising Star. And he did all this without Lasix. And then he went on and he swept all the P races at Belmont, the Pilgrim, the Poker, and the Pennine Ridge over 2, 3, and 4. You know, he wins the Breeders' Cup, at Del Mar, you know, breaking from the 13 hole and having that, you know, brilliant speed to get over, make the first turn and then set the pace and then, you know, quicken away from him. And so at 2, he showed brilliance. At 3, he wins the 2 grade ones that he can win, the Secretariat and the, Belmont Derby. And then at 4, he sets a world record at a mile in 1:31.23, equaled the world record, sorry, broke Elusive Quality's 20-year track record. And, you know, those at every stage of his life, he's been brilliant. And so to have raised him on the farm for John and Jerry Ammerman, who are such, you know, dear friends and clients, and to be able to bring him back here and really feel great confidence that he can contribute to the breed going forward, I mean, that's what we're all about. And so it's a tremendous honor. We're showcasing his weanlings here in the fall. And can't wait for really the world to see him. The first two will sell at the Night of the Stars at Fasig Tipton. And then we ourselves at Millridge have, 6 more cataloged at Keeneland November, because we want to show the world that, you know, the quality of these individuals.
Before I let you get out of here, I want you to talk about horse country a little bit. I know obviously in the pandemic, the whole tourist thing not really happening right now, but I just think a lot of the ears listening right now would be super interested in coming in and touring a farm and being able to see the things that you're talking about. I figure horse country might be the perfect vehicle for a lot of listeners to do that when we eventually get through this difficult time in our nation's history.
No, absolutely. And we actually are giving tours right now. We have.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. So we actually Millridge, Lane's End, Claiborne, a number are giving tours. And if you go to visithorsecountry.com, you can see the full schedule of where of experiences that can be had, new vocations to see. You know, again, we are so privileged to live in Kentucky and to work with thoroughbreds and to you know, and forever we hadn't done a great job of sharing the horses with the general public. You know, I think my grandmother would probably have said that, you know, it was the racetrack's job to fall in love with the horse because that was where the turnstile was. And it was easier. But in reality, you know, and I appreciate that perspective, but we now have the ability and the technology to make it easier to host people on the farm and share horses with people. You know, I use the example of an Olympic athlete who, an Olympic rower for the Canadian national team, who are, he and I are good friends. And he would describe training for the Olympic trials and tapering basically for a year and then, you know, doing long rows to short rows and then not doing anything the week before the Olympics. And it was the only time the team actually fought, because they had all this energy built up that they were meant to then release at the trials. And to me, that's how, that's what a trainer's job is in getting a horse ready to go to a race, right? You get them so fit. And then they go to the race and perform at their highest level. And I've never been that fit. You know, I'm not an Olympic athlete, so I don't really have that much in common with horses in the paddock, but I do have a lot more in common with horses on the farm and in our fields, because I have, we have a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. So I can relate to watching, you know, the maturity, and relate to watching the nurture of a mother with its foal. I see it in my own life. And so it's, to me, it's a, it, horse country is a, again, it's a nonprofit to help make it easier for farms like ourselves and the 40 other farms to make it easier to give an experience to a guest, to help people, you know, understand the full story of the horse, to fall in love with the sport. And I find it to be each on each of the farms, at the veterinary clinics, at the after facilities, we have more relatable, or relatable, I shouldn't say more relatable, but relatable aspects of a horse's life to really try and drive home and the development of a relationship with between human and horse. Because at the end of the day, that's why we wake up, is to, you know, work with the animals that we're privileged to be able to associate with. So
I think there's no better place to leave it than there, Price. Really appreciate your time today, your thoughts on horsemen, horse players, and the horses themselves at the center of the drama. And I think you've given folks some good ideas, not just for their horse playing, but also for future visits when we get to that point. I mean, heck, if you're local and it's easy for you to get there now, it doesn't sound like you have to wait. But I know a lot of people will be very excited when we have the opportunity to go to Keeneland again and put a trip to a farm on your itinerary. I would call it an absolute must if you're heading down there. You know, I lied because I thought of one more question I'm going to have to ask you, because you are not just associated with one key thing that your state produces in these beautiful thoroughbreds, but I know you're also a whiskey drinker. And I just wanted to ask you, what are you drinking right now? What exciting spirit, presumably coming out of Kentucky, has been getting popped recently in your after dinner consumption?
You know, I guess I would leave you with two. One would be the Castle and Key gin. That's been kind of our summer drink was Castle and Key gin. And actually, there's a restaurateur in Charleston, South Carolina, with Kentucky roots named Brooks Reitz, and he makes a frozen gin and tonic that with Jack Rudy's tonic syrup that is out of sight. It is so good. So that is what I was drinking this summer. And then our friends at Bardstown Bourbon Company, to me, are just making fantastic whiskey and bourbon. And so I've been drinking some of that as well. So those would be my two cocktail tips. But if you haven't had a frozen gin and tonic, it is fantastic.
You mentioned Bardstown Bourbon. They're doing some of those fun blends. I wish I could remember the particulars, but it was like a rye that was a very old rye and a younger rye that I think they distilled. And I actually had it for the first time visiting you a couple meets back at Keeneland, and I liked it so much I went and bought a bottle of it, which is now gone, and I need to replenish. So I appreciate you reminding me about the Bardstown Bourbon Company.
Absolutely. No, that's exactly right. That's I think it's the Fusion series that has a rye and a wheat, and it's just a cool, I just really enjoy it. But now, you know, now we're post Labor Day and the weather's turning, so we can get back into the brown water. But I will say that it'll be hard to leave the frozen gin and tonic.
I know what you'll be drinking now at Breeders' Cup. Price, thank you so much for your time today. What Absolutely. An enjoyable visit. And, you know, no good deed goes unpunished around here. We're going to bring you back soon, maybe to do some handicapping. We'll get you looking at some maiden races with us.
I'd love it. It'd be great. It'd be an honor. So you all keep doing what you're doing. It's really, it's elevating the sport so much, and can't say thank you enough, because you're doing a great job. So keep it up.
You're too kind. Cheers, my friend.
Adios, Pete. We'll talk to you soon.
That's going to do it for today's show. I want to thank our guests, first and foremost, Ashley Mayu and Price Bell. We're going to also thank our other partners, including Sportblocks. For more information about them and their new offerings, go to sportblx.com. We'll also thank our friends at Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation and also at 10 Strike Racing. They've been with us since the beginning. We appreciate everything they do so much. Hey, speaking of TRF, we still have a few bottles of this In the Money Players Podcast whiskey left. We're going to be sending out a shipment soon. Go to trfinc.org/players and make your donation to get your bottle today. Also, just a heads up, October 20th is going to be this Blackburn Farm Tour. You're going to get to learn so much more about the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation and their Second Chances program. Save the date. We'll be talking about it a lot more as we get closer. But the horse show from Blackburn is going to be something that you don't want to miss if you care about thoroughbred racing. So keep that one in mind. Most of all, though, I want to thank all of you, the listeners, for making these shows so much fun to do. And we're going to get out of here. With that said, this show has been a production of In the Money Media. Our business manager is Drew Cotney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos!